This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And if you are wondering where your Edward Snowden is at this hour, I don't know if we're going to be able to help you. The NSA leaker is either in the air, in Moscow, in Cuba, in Venezuela, or in Ecuador, or anywhere else in the world except Hong Kong. That we know. He left there over the weekend after being encouraged to go by Chinese authorities, according to some reports, and told that no one would stop him by Hong Kong authorities, according to some other reports. None of this is making the Obama administration feel very good about the issue of who's the next leaker. Later this hour, an initiative that suggests the administration might be worried it could come from the Peace Corps or the Social Security Administration. But we begin with a curious day for the U.S. Supreme Court. With so much before it, once again, the court has held off on issuing two expected decisions on gay marriage and one on voting rights. It seems to have avoided altogether a big decision in the affirmative action case Fisher versus the University of Texas. Joining us now to talk about this, Kareem Creighton, professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What exactly happened in the Fisher case here? It was bumped back to the Fifth Circuit. Why and how unusual is that?
Well, sometimes the court decides that a case that has already gone through the briefing and the argument was maybe not properly heard in the first place so that it could be sent back for further proceedings. And that's what happened here. By a vote of 7-1, the court basically said, we don't think that the circuit court, the court below, did all of the findings that it could have done or perhaps should have done under the rules to determine whether or not the affirmative action policy at the University of Texas sort of complied with the rules that they stated in a previous case called Grutter. And so they've sent the case back for further proceedings to make that clear.
Now, I'm no law student and I'm no judge, but I am part of, you know, the jury of Americans here. Wouldn't that be the kind of thing they would have suggested at the beginning when they decided to take the case from the Fifth Circuit? Wouldn't they have made that clear then? Isn't that exactly the kind of thing that they would have ruled on when they issued the writ that they're actually going to consider the case?
It's a fair point. I think many times when the court gets a case, at this stage, everything has been litigated and most of the procedural matters have been dealt with. But it could be that the issue wasn't necessarily as clear to all of the justices until the arguments were made in front of it. And so, you know, one way of reading this is that, you know, a judge or a series of justices now agree that more time needs to be had, more evidence needs to be presented to the lower court in order to come up with the best factual analysis of whether or not the case actually, again, survives the rule that the court set up in Grutter. Of course, the other answer to this could be an opinion was written and a number of judges just couldn't all agree. And so the only thing they could agree about was to send it back.
All right. So if you're in a university administrator and you're watching this very, very closely, what do you take from this? What do you think is going to happen in the Fifth Circuit? How will this get sharpened to the point where maybe the court would make a decision that would have implications for higher education?
That's a very good point. I think, frankly, if you're a university administrator, you're probably pulling your hair out and looking at every word and every sentence to try and gain some clue about what the Supreme Court is looking for. So on the one hand, they've sent this case back suggesting that the effort to overturn the Texas policy was not enough. It wasn't strong enough to win the day. On the other hand, there are people, I'm sure, who attacked this policy who say, well, it seems that some justices, Justice Scalia being one of them, is only bothered by the fact that there was no frontal attack on the rule that the court set forth in Grutter, which says that maybe diversity isn't the best, strongest, compelling rationale for having an affirmative action plan. So both sides will go back to the drawing board trying to pull as many clues from this case as possible, I think.
Well, affirmative action, of course, a big issue in American life, but small arcane details there in this decision that's going back to the Fifth Circuit. Perhaps the court has a bigger appetite for some bigger constitutional questions, and we have a couple of indications. A case on sex offenders really involves the question of ex post facto, whether the court can impose something on individuals who were adjudicated before a law was passed, if a law applies to people who had something happen to them before the law was passed. Can you explain the sex offenders case to us briefly?
Sure. Essentially, the person whose rights are at issue had been convicted of an offense that was later listed among those sorts of criminal acts that are subject to registration rules. That's the Offender Act that's being challenged here. And the court said basically that even though this person had served their time prior to the time that this congressional statute was adopted, the person was still subject to its rules. And while some people might have argued, as he did, that this is sort of after-the-fact application, the court in a lot of ways seemed to believe that, well, he was still under some sort of supervision, and therefore it wasn't sort of it wasn't the same kind of rule where you look back and try to bring people into a class of people that you regulate. Rather, he was always among the people that were still under federal supervision. In that case, he still had to do some compliance requirements, and they said that the new rule should apply to him. And Chief Justice Roberts, just to add one small point, said that, well, you know, this might not necessarily be justified under the police power, as in passing criminal law, but it could be justified under the necessary and proper clause, suggesting that things necessary to carry out a goal that Congress announces are still within its constitutional power to accomplish.
And the court also announced today that they are going to take up the question of the recessed appointments at the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, which is another separation of powers question. Can recess appointments supersede Senate advice and consent requirements under the Constitution? We'll know about that in the next term. Generally speaking, do you think the court is weary of its 5-4 narrow split, doesn't really want to issue these kinds of narrow decisions, and is maybe having some trouble with these big cases?
Well, I think at least some people on the court, probably the Chief Justice, since he's among the newer members and is likely to be there for some time, is definitely concerned about the credibility of the court to make decisions, as he says, in ways that call balls and strikes as opposed to playing politics. And so I think they're going to be very concerned in the next, you know, few terms, certainly as this one closes, to make sure that they are appearing to the public as though they're making decisions based on rules and not on wants and desires. And so questions like the healthcare decision last term, certainly the voting rights decision coming up in the next few days, and as you point out, the recess appointment issue will be important not just for the outcome, who wins and who loses, but I think the level of rationale and justification that's present in what the court decides. So the 5-4 decisions, I think, are going to be tests of that credibility. But I think regardless of whether it's 5-4 or 6-3 or more, the test really is going to come in the level of justification that's evident in the writings that support the opinions the court issues.
Well, what we're seeing in this term is the credibility of the Roberts Court on trial in a certain extent, avoiding a decision on affirmative action. And we'll see what happens with the other cases. Kareem Creighton, professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School, thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All of this non-decisioning by the Supremes there at the Supreme Court has made for something of a letdown on the steps of the Capitol, where many, many people have been waiting for the outcome of this historic court term. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, spent a little time on the steps of the Supreme Court. What was the feeling?
Not with a bang, but a whimper, John. That's how the day ended. It was hot out, as it often is during these summer decision days. Everybody's remembering back to health care last year when it was a sweaty, horrible, soggy day in Washington, and this was no different. And the activists out there, John, almost all of them were out there for the Proposition 8 and DOMA cases. They were disappointed. They got an affirmative action ruling, but not the one they were waiting for. I talked to a fellow named Skylar Mays. He's 28. He's about to go into the military on active duty and is very concerned if he chooses to get married, where his marriage will be valid if he's stationed in Maryland or Virginia, and then he goes back home to Arkansas. John, Skylar is sick of waiting. Listen.
It's really ridiculous. It's unfortunate that our court can't come to just a general agreement about equal rights for everyone. That's very unfortunate. It seems clearly they're having a struggle deciding on how they're going to rule, or have already been released.
Well, we don't know if they're having a struggle on the Prop 8 and Defense of Marriage Act decision. Certainly they had a struggle on the affirmative action case, which was kicked back to the Fifth Circuit. I guess the question is, next week or even by Thursday, we should know the outcome of this particular case. Is there any sense that the court is moving slow because of some concern among the justices themselves?
Nobody ever really knows, John, why they do this. Now, the court is famous for leaving the biggest decisions till the very end of the session, the bitter end. The same happened with healthcare. We all remember that pretty much at the same time of year. So we can't get inside the minds of Justice Roberts and the rest of them about why they're waiting so long. Is it because there's a difficulty in reaching a decision or a balance that they're trying to strike between Prop 8 and DOMA? There's no way to know that. But the court can also add as many days to the session as they choose in order to keep issuing rulings. It would appear now that this Thursday is that day, although we can't even know that for sure. They could bring it as long as they want, but we're expecting, finally, Thursday to have a ruling not only on Proposition 8 from California and the Defense of Marriage Act, but also the remaining voting rights case, which is a big one, John.
Theoretically open-ended, but the best will be saved for last if those two cases do come down on Thursday. Is there any sense, even in Washington, that there is a weariness with the 5-4 narrowness of this court's majority and of the decisions, therefore, that it issues?
If there is a weariness with that, it got placated a little bit today by the broad ruling remanding the affirmative action case back to the court in Texas. So maybe that helped solve that a little bit, John, even though it was not the most major case. I'll tell you the big expectation here in Washington in particular, Proposition 8, of course, and also the Defense of Marriage Act. Why DOMA so much? It's a federal statute that affects the recognition of marriage under federal law, tax law, the IRS and all the rest of it. And of course, as we all know, it is the House Republicans under John Boehner that are parties to the case. They're the one who stepped up to defend the Defense of Marriage Act after the Obama administration reversed itself and refused to defend this law in court. So there are a lot of watchers, not only on the gay rights issue, but also on the effect that it has on the House Republicans and their stance against gay marriage is sort of the standard bearers of conservatism here in Washington, John.
Talking to us from Capitol Hill, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The machinations of Edward Snowden, or his itinerary over the past few days, is a plot line that is very John le Carré meets Carl Hiaasen, if this were a comic novel, which it is not. Where in the world is Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker? Is it Moscow?
A huge plane took off headed for Havana, which I would say about half of the Moscow-based press corps on it. People had really scrambled to get tickets on that flight and to get here, because they believed that he was going to be sitting in seat 17A, it became clear that Snowden wasn't on the plane, or at least he wasn't visible to anyone who was on the plane.
That's Ellen Barry, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, describing a completely strange few days of reports of Snowden appearing in Moscow and then mysteriously disappearing. It's believed that Snowden will eventually end up in Ecuador, possibly by way of Cuba or Venezuela. Would that be a homecoming? Ecuador technically is currently the home of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is currently holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in Britain. And that connection may be why Ecuador is said to be formally considering a request for asylum by fugitive Edward Snowden. Why Ecuador? We spoke with Will Grant, Mexico and Central America correspondent for the BBC in Quito, Ecuador, where anticipation of a Snowden arrival, whether it happens or not, is growing.
There's certainly a lot of press gathering Quito now. People have been gathering, have been appearing, essentially following this route that we've heard is expected to be the route from Russia, but it's still so unclear exactly what's happening now. People are wondering whether or not they are also going to be as sort of empty-handed, if you like, as journalists, as the Russian press corps on the trip to Cuba. But I guess we will find out whether or not he makes it to Ecuador in the coming hours and days.
Well, this certainly has all the frenzy of the arrival of a pope, but of course it's a very different story. Will Grant, how have people in Ecuador followed the Julian Assange case of the Ecuadorian embassy there in Britain? Is there a sense of nationalism, of identity, of pride associated with harboring Julian Assange? And then what are we to make of where the Edward Snowden case would take all of this?
I think there's a mixture, really, of a certain degree of pride for those who support President Rafael Correa, in as much as they agree that Ecuador should be a sort of safe haven for whistleblowers, should be the sort of place that they believe is backing people who, from their point of view, are important in terms of the freedom of press and so on, and basically follow Rafael Correa, President Rafael Correa's argument about granting political asylum to Mr. Assange. But also, I think there's a sense of bemusement again by Ecuadorians that their little country in the Andes, if you like, has been sort of put at the center of this maelstrom about international freedoms, about spying, about whistleblowing, and suddenly they seem to be right at the heart of this question again. I think very much it depends on one's point of view here in Ecuador. Obviously, Rafael Correa has a lot of support. He just won recently the election here with a very, very big majority. So I would say most of his backers sort of broadly welcome both the Julian Assange decision and, if it comes, the decision in favor of Mr. Snowden as well.
And it certainly wouldn't be the first time in world history that an odd species, one of a kind, made its home in Ecuador, the Galapagos Islands. If we're to recall the Darwin expedition to Ecuador, I mean, Edward Snowden embodies characteristics of a saboteur and of a spy. I'm wondering if there's any tradition in Ecuador of monitoring domestic communications, if, you know, the Snowden charges could apply to Ecuador as well as the United States.
Well, the whole question of communications, control of the media is always rethrown up here in Ecuador after the situation with Mr. Assange and his request and eventually granted for political asylum. There are a lot of people saying that there was an irony in as much as Mr. Correa, President Correa, has a very tight control of the press, that there's very restrictive press laws here that have gone through. He argues the opposite, that in fact what he's doing is breaking down decades of control of the press by just a handful of wealthy families. And that's an ongoing argument here. In terms of listening in terms of wiretapping, in terms of espionage, that's something I think which hasn't really been dominating the press here. But I was the correspondent in Venezuela for many years, and certainly there was always a lot of paranoia about people listening to phone calls and strange recordings appearing on television. So it is certainly part of the kind of general fabric, the situation in this part of the world at the moment.
Well, Will Grant evokes some of that paranoia for us now. I suspect there are all kinds of scenarios here. Has the U.S. Embassy been speaking about this? If Snowden were to land and show up in Ecuador, would he be paraded about very publicly? Would he be whisked away? Would the U.S. attempt to grab him on the streets of Ecuador? Any of those?
I don't think for the time being that the U.S. Embassy are going to say anything. That I think they're probably leaving it to Washington. John Kerry has obviously been speaking. I think in terms of also the sort of jingoism of parading him, I think that wouldn't be hugely in Ecuador's best interest. But that's not to say that it won't happen. And because, of course, we didn't get the chance to see Julian Assange on in Quito. He's only been in the embassy in London. We can't really compare yet to that situation, but one would suspect he'd probably do interviews, he'd probably be reasonably public, and there would be some kind of welcoming committee if he were to make it to Ecuadorian soil.
Would he be offered an academic position like Chinese dissidents are often offered here in the United States?
That might be the kind of situation they find for him. Really, I think all of those questions, all the finer details of what he would do if he makes it here, he still has a long way to go. We don't yet know whether or not he's winging his way to Havana, whether or not he's going to pass through Caracas. It's still, I think, the fact that he's not clearly on this flight, and it's not to say he's not definitely on the flight to Havana, makes it much harder to know exactly what will be coming next.
Waiting for Snowden, perhaps it's the title of Will Grant's latest memoir. He's the Mexico and Central America correspondent for the BBC, waiting for Edward Snowden, perhaps destination Ecuador. Thanks so much. So So with the U.S. slipping out of the picture militarily in Afghanistan, a withdrawal underway, a military command symbolically handed over to the Afghanistan military, and what NATO called Milestone 2013, you might be forgiven for thinking that the endgame in the war in Afghanistan has become a shrinking regional dispute with little relevance to the rest of the world. But an even bigger milestone for Afghanistan is the possible peace talks in Doha, Qatar, with the Taliban, U.S. representatives, and the Afghan government. They represent the opening of a conversation on real Afghan sovereignty for the first time since 1979, when the Soviets invaded. And now, President Hamid Karzai was just a college student in India back in 79. Now Karzai might be at the head of the table, though, at the talks in Doha, if he decides to show up.
The talks, having begun in Qatar, must immediately be moved to Afghanistan. Second, that the talks must bring about an end to violence in Afghanistan.
Meanwhile, the Taliban are being very aggressive in their demands, threatening at one point to use a flag that suggested they constitute a legitimate government in exile. They backed down on that, while also proposing exchanging an American prisoner of war for five of the most senior members of the Taliban held at Guantanamo Bay. Joining us now is Bruce Riedel, senior fellow and director of the Brookings Intelligence Project, former senior advisor to the last four U.S. presidents on South Asia and the Middle East. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a milestone for Afghanistan, should it really begin to discuss what sovereignty means at this point in its history after decades of war, right?
That's right. This has the potential of being incredibly important. Afghanistan is a country that's now been at war for 35 years. If Afghans can find a way to sit around a negotiating table and come up with a formula for reconciliation, that would be the best outcome for them, the best outcome for the region, and the best outcome for the United States.
What would be on the table here? Obviously, reconciliation and power sharing on some level between the Taliban and the government of Hamid Karzai, but there have also been discussions over the last 35 years of partition, of essentially recognizing the regional differences that exist in Afghanistan by making separate autonomous territories, that sort of thing.
The potential deal would probably devolve a lot of power from the central government in Kabul to provincial governors. And then each provincial governor would decide a lot about the politics of his region. That way, the northern part of the country, which is populated mostly by Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Shia, could continue to be relatively modern and progressive, while the southern part, dominated by Pashtuns, might look a lot more like the old Taliban Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. But we're a long way from that right now. We're still in the initial game of posturing over the shape of the table, if you like. Whether or not the Afghan Taliban are really serious about negotiating with the Karzai government at all, or whether they came to Doha simply to secure some propaganda points.
What do you make of the possible prisoner exchange process that's maybe being discussed, some indication that the U.S. is not rejecting it out of hand?
The possibility of a prisoner exchange has been on the table now for a couple of years. In principle, I think it's a good deal. We get our GI home, they get five guys from Guantanamo. The difficulty in the past has been, how do we make sure that the five Guantanamo detainees are not released back onto the battlefield in Afghanistan and go back to shooting at other American GIs? The proposal has been that they somehow stay in Doha. Well, Qatar's performance in the last week on these questions of the flag and the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan plaque, I think, are going to leave a lot of questions about whether the Qataris can really be promised to live up to any commitment to keep these guys under some kind of house arrest and control in Doha.
You don't see the government of Qatar as an honest broker here?
Well, I don't think that their initial performance is all that reassuring. They must have known that the Taliban were going to put that flag up, and they must have seen the sign on the wall, it's as big as you can possibly be, proclaiming the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. They should have called a halt to the whole process as soon as they walked in the door and said, hey, we need to start over again. They didn't. Hopefully they've learned some lessons from this escapade. But I think the United States is going to have to keep a very close eye on its Qatari partner in this negotiations process.
What is the chance that these talks turn into, you know, Vietnam-Paris talks, where it's essentially just a way for the U.S. to get out of Afghanistan and then everything falls apart, or a process that we alluded to earlier of essentially creating warlordocracy, where the devolution of Afghanistan becomes simply a recognition of warlord territories, and there's really no sovereignty at the end of this at all?
There's a high risk of many kinds of failures in all of this and low probability of success, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't pursue the option of negotiations. But we need to be very careful as we go forward. The perception throughout the region, and particularly in Afghanistan's neighbor Pakistan, is that the United States does want to cut and run, and that this episode in Doha last week with the flag and the plaque was only the greatest, latest indication of the American desire to just get out of Afghanistan at any cost whatsoever, and that we're prepared to abandon everything that we've done in Afghanistan for the last 12 years. I think John Kerry is going to have a considerable amount of work to do to convince people in the region that that's not the case. His special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Jim Dobbins, is on his way to Kabul today, and I think he's going to have to make a pretty compelling case to Hamid Karzai that the United States is not on the verge of just cutting and running.
Quickly before we go, does Karzai survive this? Will he be the president when 2015 begins?
Karzai's term in office is up in 2014. I talked to him 2 weeks ago, and he says he's serious. He doesn't want the job anymore. He's tired of it. He wants to retire. I think we should hold him to that commitment. I think it's time for Afghanistan to have another president. Hamid Karzai has served his country well, but there are term limits in Qatar, just as there are in the United States, and his term limit is running up, and I think it's time for another leader to step forward.
Talks about sovereignty and succession in Afghanistan in the talks that are taking place in Qatar. Bruce Riedel, senior fellow and director of the Brookings Intelligence Project and former senior advisor to the last four U.S. presidents on South Asia and the Middle East. Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I was driven to do pageants because it's something different for a girl with a physical disability.
There's a pretty amazing moment in store for you if you tune into HBO tonight. It's not a reality show, but it is a documentary about a reality you would never see unless you went looking for it.
What I like about this pageant is it gives me a chance to tell other people that I can be anyone that I want to be and I can do anything that I like to do.
In Kewaunee, Illinois, the Miss You Can Do It beauty pageant has been around since 2008. And on stage are dozens of little girls with severe disabilities, some of whom can't walk, some of whom can't speak, but they all beam with the chance to be noticed and celebrated for their beauty in front of a packed house of parents and friends. The Miss You Can Do It pageant is the brainchild of Abby Curran, the 2008 Miss Iowa, who was the first woman with a disability, she was born with cerebral palsy, to compete in the Miss USA pageant. You heard her moment of victory in the Miss Iowa pageant there just a moment ago. I spoke with former beauty queen Abby on stage at the HBO New York premiere last week. She was as nervous and excited as she once was waiting to hear her name called.
When I see the documentary, I kind of get it, but I mean, I'm lucky that one of my best friends from elementary school is here tonight, and she grew up with me. I can't believe I would be inspiring. I mean, me? Just, you know, falling down.
That's pretty hard to imagine.
Tripping all over. So it's just really hard to believe, but I'm really flattered.
I've seen this movie three times, and as my daughter has as well. And, you know, it's amazing, even on the third time, just to see how big of a punch it packs here. In some ways, though, the story really just begins with this pageant, the story of you. Mm-hmm. You never had this pageant. You were always alone up mm-hmm. there in the beauty pageants that you experienced. In a sense, is this pageant an answer to the question of what you might have wished you'd had as a young girl?
No. No. I'm too stubborn. So if somebody would have said, oh, you know, we created a pageant for girls with disabilities, I would have said, well, I'm going to be Miss USA, so I'll compete in that next year. But the point of Miss You Can Do It is not to separate the two. It's not to separate Miss USA from those girls from Miss You Can Do It girls. The point of The pageant is to inspire these women. I don't know if they are blessed enough to have parents like mine telling me to pick up your feet, you know, do this, do that, you can walk by yourself, which is amazing because otherwise I probably would be sitting in a wheelchair today saying, you know, forget it, why do I have to walk if I don't have to?
Not that there's anything wrong with wheelchairs.
Right. But if mom wasn't telling me, you know, she hates this story, but she has these darn rugs in the kitchen. She loves them. You know, they're, what, little flags, American flags on them? Beautiful. Beautiful when you look at them, when you're smacking the ground because you didn't pick up your feet far enough and you tripped on them. And what does she say? She doesn't say, oh, honey, let's pick up the rug. She goes, pick up your feet, Abby.
Well, you see a lot of the parents in this movie expressing that same kind of toughness, also worries about entering. Oh, I think Tiana's mom said it, it's a tough world out there. You're not sheltered. What was the experience like of being the only one at the beauty pageant in your own personal experience?
I mean, I was nervous, very nervous, but it was a good, overall good experience. I mean, everyone was pretty nice. The girls were all nice. Everyone was helpful.
Do you think the audience for Miss USA and the values that the Miss USA pageant represents embraced you and your presence in that? Or was it a real challenge for them to see you, to embrace you, and to figure out that this is a world with all kinds of people in it, not just Barbies?
I think it started out as them being overly wonderful. I came in
pitying
and they told me that I was a novelty, mm-hmm. which you never like to hear. And then everyone gets a hostess, which was great, only I realized that my hostess was even picking up my underwear and putting them on me. And finally I was like, wait a minute, I can put my own underpants on. I really don't need all of your help. Just a little walking would be fine. And then finally, I kind of got really frustrated, and I called my state directors, and I was like, they have to back off. I don't want this. And so then they did a 360 and pretty much, you know, go on, have fun.
So in many ways, even for the pageant winners who are in this film, the hard questions for them, able-bodied or disabled, is what are you going to do after the pageant? Because your whole life is ahead of you.
Right.
How do you tackle that question?
I want to design, not only do I want to inspire and change the world for people with disabilities forever, but I'd love to start my own shoe line. I mean, I just did a photo shoot for Vogue not too long ago, and I felt so bad. But the lady is trying to squeeze my feet that go like this. She's trying to squeeze them into these little, like, pointed stilettos. And she's like, oh, I got it. So she's sitting down there forever, and then my, like, pinky toes popping out, and I'm like, oh. And so I want to create a way that shoes just can be wider. There's just a few things that need to be changed so that people with disabilities can be sexy. They can look good. They don't have to wear a dress with tennis shoes or even these ugly little heels that are the only pair that I can wear. That they can wear anything they want.
That's Abby Curran, a former Miss Iowa who created the Miss You Can Do It pageant for girls with disabilities. A new documentary about the pageant premieres tonight on HBO. There are more than 7 billion people on planet Earth, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. That's a fact. Infertility, it would seem, in the human species is not the number one planetary concern. But this fact is of little solace to women around the world trying to choose when to have kids and to figure out their chances of getting pregnant. Such questions, from culture to culture and place to place, are subject to the speculative theories of folk medicine, myths handed down from generation to generation, and sometimes simply junk science. For American women who have grown up believing that prime childbearing years are in their 20s and early 30s, and that by 40, fertility drops off to the point that you might assume childbearing is unlikely, if not impossible, well, a clock is ticking. But it might not be a biological clock. Let's go for some facts here. Dr. Ann Steiner is professor in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Steiner, welcome.
Thank you.
What message are women in their early 30s getting from doctors, from authoritative sources of information on fertility, of their likelihood of having kids in their 30s?
Well, I think most people are not given specific numbers, but in general advise that fertility does tend to decline in women after age 30 in a gradual fashion and more drastically in the late 30s.
And so the CDC says many women are waiting until their 30s and 40s to have children. In fact, about 20% of women in the United States now have their first child after 35. And this leads to age becoming a growing cause of fertility problems. About one third of couples in which the woman is older than 35 years have fertility problems. That scares women.
Yes, I think it does. And I think it has a lot to do with the difference, honestly, in our scientific terms of incidence and prevalence. If you think about the fact that over time, having infertility can build up, you can get to, at the time point in over age 35, a third of women having infertility. But if you look at it from the perspective of, I've never had fertility issues, and now I'm trying, what is my likelihood of having infertility? That's a very different question. And it is going to be likely lower than a third. So I think definitely after a year, and actually the American Society for Reproductive Medicine would say after 6 months, one should consider seeing a specialist.
All right. That's Dr. Ann Steiner, professor in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Hold on there. We also have with us Erin White Ulvey, a 31-year-old mother of twins. Congratulations, Erin.
Thank you so much.
So who started your biological clock ticking?
You know, I think it really became a concern for me when I was about 29 and visited for my annual checkup, and my doctor pointed out that if I wanted to have, you know, more than one child, that I should start thinking about having it soon because my fertility would start declining after 30.
And did you make a decision on the basis of that checkup?
Actually, my husband and I were engaged at the time, and we decided that we were going to start trying for children sooner. We got lucky and had a big surprise in that we got pregnant with identical twins without trying at all. So, but we definitely wanted to make sure that our timeline would accommodate having more than one child. So we were planning on trying earlier than we might have had we known that, you know, it wouldn't be as hard as we thought it could be.
Do you think the fertility industry, doctors, with cautious information are trying to scare women? Or do you think women scare women by repeating these stories over and over again and paying a lot of attention to Time magazine, for instance, which put this on the cover one time?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. I wouldn't say that my doctor tried to scare me. I think that he was trying to present me realistic options, that it was easier to have, if you wanted to have a big family, it was easier to start early. I do think that among my friends, making decisions about career and those kind of things, I think talking about it and looking at media reports, there is kind of a collective panic when you hit 30 and you do want to have a family of when do you start and how soon and what kind of decisions do you make to make that possible.
But you're way ahead of the game right now, Erin.
I did. We got a big surprise bonus.
All right. Hold on there. Dr. Ann Steiner. So on this question of panic when you're 30, it's more like panic when you're 40, even if panic is probably the wrong word in both cases.
I agree. I think we need to start shifting a little bit that kind of fearful time period. I really do think in the 30s, we should be aware in the early 30s that it's not indefinite. But I think I need to get my rear in action. That kind of thing is more towards the end of the 30s.
Talking to Dr. Ann Steiner on her Skype connection there at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Dr. Steiner, could you comment on a report in the Atlantic magazine, which really motivated all of this, at least on our staff, that some aspect of the statistics that are used to describe this precipitous drop in probability in the 30s came from some data in France from, you know, centuries ago?
Well, I think how we used to do our studies is we go and we would look at different populations and we'd say how many women or how many couples in this population want to be pregnant right now and are not pregnant. So these are kind of cross-sectional data. Whereas now we're doing studies, we're enrolling couples who are just starting to try to get pregnant and follow them and see how long it takes them to get pregnant. Most of these studies enroll women that don't have a problem with infertility because we know that they, if somebody has problems or is infertile, that they are already infertile and there's no need for them to be in our study. So it all depends on the question that you're asking. If you're asking a question, what is my likelihood of getting pregnant, then the studies that we're doing now is more appropriate. If you're asking what is the prevalence or how big is this problem of infertility in our society, those cross-sectional studies are still relevant.
All right. So finally, then, it appears that as you enter your 30s, your chances of getting pregnant if you try for a year are something on the order of, 89% if you're healthy. It slips down to 78% by the time you get to 40 and then drops pretty significantly after that. Is that factual, Dr. Steiner?
I don't think that's unreasonable if you're talking about if you've never had problems in the past. And more than likely, I think those numbers may be slightly inflated because most of them include women that have gotten pregnant before. If you've never been pregnant before, you may have infertility issues, or if you've never tried before, you may have infertility issues and you may not know it. And it may have nothing to do with reproductive aging. So I think those numbers are probably more applicable to couples that have had kids before. And the numbers may be slightly lower at age 40 or in the late 30s for women that have never tried before.
So Aaron White, you can really, really chill out here until you're...
Absolutely. I plan on chilling out. I think two is enough for me right now.
Aaron White will be, congratulations, a 31-year-old new mother of twins, and Dr. Ann Steiner is associate professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Quote, hammer this fact home. Leaking is tantamount to aiding the enemies of the United States, end quote. Now, that's not surprising, coming from a Department of Defense strategy memo, I suppose, but what is the message to employees of the Social Security Administration, the Department of Agriculture, the Peace Corps? Has the Obama administration gone all corporate on us, on itself? The McClatchy News Service has put together a picture of an Obama initiative called the Insider Threat Program. The program gives government agencies greater authority to investigate and punish potential leakers. Does it go much beyond your standard issue corporate policy on talking to the media? Or is it a form of government-coerced restraint with constitutional implications? With us is Marissa Taylor, investigative reporter for McClatchy, who reported on the Insider Threat Program. Marissa, welcome.
Hello.
Also,
thanks.
Kel McClanahan is an attorney specializing in national security law and information law. Kel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Marissa, what is the scale of this program, and how do you see it as being connected across all government agencies?
Well, the program is designed to prevent leaks of classified information, and we found that the president's executive order that came after WikiLeaks gave agencies more latitude to go after the release of even unclassified information as a security violation. And instead of just focusing on the intelligence communities, agencies, as has been done in the past after major leaks, this has broadened out to other agencies that are not intelligence or defense agencies, where they are being expected to take account of leaks of their own.
Give me a feel for some of the language in these memos and warnings to employees. It seems as though they're trying to encourage employees to inform on each other, watch out for people who are having crises in their lives. It might make them a threat. Look for outsiders, that sort of thing. What have you found, and what agencies have seen these kinds of warnings?
Well, we found that it was it varied This program at this point is still being crafted. So agencies, however, are already urging their employees, such as the Department of Education and Department of Agriculture and elsewhere, to look for certain behaviors that could offer clues that someone might be an insider threat, who might be contemplating becoming a spy or a leaker. And that includes a lot of common experiences that many Americans have, such as going through a divorce and having financial problems. So it struck people we talked to as a potential overreach, in the sense that it's going beyond the agencies that are accustomed to looking for this kind of security violation and urging non-intelligence agencies to do the same as intelligence agencies.
That's Marissa Taylor, investigative reporter for the McClatchy News Service, who reported on the Insider Threat Program being crafted by the Obama administration to deal with internal leaks. Kel McClanahan, what latitude, legally speaking, does the government have to prosecute or go after individuals who speak to the media out of some chain of corporate communications?
Well, there's prosecute and then there's go after. Prosecute means bring criminal penalties against and perhaps, you know, fine them or throw them in jail or even execute them, depending on the, you know, magnitude of the leak.
And that would only apply to classified information or specific information related to national security.
Exactly. The language in the Espionage Act is information related to the national defense. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean only classified information, but it is, while broad, not completely, you know, over ambiguous. It has to be something defense or intelligence or foreign policy related.
Now, the administration claims it is bolstering protections for people who are whistleblowers, but how do you see something like this as having a chilling effect for people who might be interested in going to the press on stories that, you know, would be legitimate fare for news organizations?
Well, see, what this is it's a formalization of a bunch of ad hoc programs that different agencies have had for years. And I'm not just talking about intelligence agencies. Almost every federal agency has something along the lines of a code of conduct or of a non-disclosure agreement where an employee who goes outside the agency without authorization with agency official information can be fired, can be penalized in other ways, et cetera. This has basically put an umbrella over that and decided we already have a standard by which we can adjudicate these things set up in the security clearance context. Let's just apply that everywhere to find out who would be the type of people who would be giving this information out.
That's Attorney Kel McClanahan. Marissa Taylor, you investigated this for McClatchy. How is this a change if it's simply an umbrella of a lot of code of conduct kinds of memos that people working in the private sector have dealt with, you know, for decades?
It's a change because the context is a public one. These are public agencies, and they're expected to serve the public good. And the public good is the release of information when it's in the interest of the public. And there are concerns that this kind of broad sweeping program could have a chilling effect on the release of routine information where people are unable to even discuss things that are not classified with reporters or even anyone. And the other concern, I think, is that the language, which does apply across the government, is equating leaking with espionage. And, you know, given the fact that the definition is of leaking is rather broad in what we found, then it equates a broad release of information to espionage. And I think that it is debatable whether all leaks should be treated as espionage.
It's Marissa Taylor, an investigative reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. Kel McClanahan, can you equate espionage with leaking under any circumstances?
Under some circumstances, yes, but it's really in the nuances that the differences can be found. You know, espionage is a type of leaking. Leaking is getting information out from those people who want to protect it to the outside. Now, if you send that in a way such as to harm the government and to harm the national security and to give it to our enemies, that, I believe, is espionage. If you send it to the newspaper or to Congress or even to your own inspector general's office to expose something that the government is doing wrong, that is not espionage, especially if it has nothing to do with national security or national defense.
Is it a deep throat or is it a Snowden, really, is the question. Kel McClanahan, national security lawyer, executive director of the law firm National Security Counselors, a nonprofit public interest law firm. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Temperatures on the rise throughout the country this week. It is summer after all. We're asking you, where do you go to chill out over the summer?
For 15 years, four moms and nine kids have spent a week on Sanibel Island. We started when some of the kids were in diapers, and now some of them are college graduates, and they still come every year with their moms.
Listener Lorraine from Davie, Florida. Sanibel is beautiful. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.